from the heart of downtown Winnipeg. You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM.
The following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular host will be back with a few new episodes of original programming.
Hey folks, you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. This is your Arts Talk radio show, Eat Arts and Vegetables, coming to you from Treaty 1 here at the University of Winnipeg in Winnipeg, Canada. I'm co-host Derek Breckner. My other co-host, Zoe LeBrun, was not able to make it for this recorded interview with Rodney Latourelle from October 17th, 2025. I want to welcome Rodney Latourelle to the show. Welcome, Rodney.
Thanks. Thanks for the invitation, Derek. It's great to talk to you.
I feel like, you know, we've known each other for quite a while, yeah. And I feel like we've been trying to do this interview for a number of years now.
It's true. Yeah.
And it's finally nice to finally have that happen.
Definitely.
Maybe we can just give a little background about you, and you can. I'm going to sort of describe you a little bit, and you fill in the blank spots. I'm sure that I'm going to miss a lot here, but Rodney Latourelle is an artist, kind of working in an interdisciplinary sort of way, through the lens of architecture, amongst other things. Rodney is originally from Winnipeg, but left, I don't know, two decades ago, and is now based in Berlin. And does amazing practice with his partner, Louise Witthoft. Louise is also involved with the various projects that Rodney is involved with, too, as well. And they both, Louise and Rodney, both have an exhibition currently up at Plug-In ICA. The exhibition is called Beton Waves. And we'll get into what that means a little bit later. But welcome to the show, Rodney. Really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, happy to be here, really.
Did I miss anything in terms of like describing your background?
No, I mean, I'm from Winnipeg and I'm currently based in Berlin. And Louise and I work together on really multidisciplinary practice.
Yeah.
We do like art installations. We do public art. We have a big public art piece opening in Toronto at the Yonge and Eglinton subway. The whole line is delayed, so we're still waiting for years for this one to open. But for example, yeah, we also do public art. We work with architects and we color design.
And doesn't the National Gallery like own a piece of yours as well?
Yeah, it's a sort of a color space piece.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the thread, I guess, that we have in our practice. And we also do exhibition design as well. So we have this art and design practice that I think it's still hard to reconcile for a lot of people and a lot of artists and designers to talk. There's a dialogue to be had there,
I think. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I'm so excited to have you on the show is that, you know, just in terms of all of your work, but most recently the residency that you and Louise did at Plug-In in the summer, the Magic Creek residency, and the work from the participants from that residency, and then, of course, your work here with Beton Waves, which is currently up at Plug-In. Both of those projects, in my mind, make me think about things in a way that I'm not used to thinking. That, in my mind, is always a good sign, I think. It's like...
Great. I mean, we tend not to focus on objects, you know, the traditional art object.
Right.
So you don't see... like small sculptures and small things in our work. We really work with space as the medium. That's the main thing. And it's the encounter with space that is the kind of what we try to articulate and fill out. And so it's this encounter. It's Beton Waves.
Like Beton, okay. Beton,
like Beton Brut. So okay. Beton is, you know, concrete in French. And with some recent work, we referred to kind of brutalism. And brutal architecture.
So, but I was just going to say, like, I know what brutalism is in terms of architecture.
Right.
But maybe you could, for our listeners, maybe you could just describe briefly what brutalist architecture is.
Basically characterized by unfinished concrete or rough concrete, or actually concrete that is exposed, but often finished in different ways, actually.
Like I've heard the term truth to materials. Would that be a good way to describe it?
Yeah, but, you know, a lot of architecture is like that. Say, architecture that you might call critical regionalism that is modern, works with local materials and tries to find a contemporary expression. But brutalism kind of started with Le Corbusier's Marseille block.
Okay.
In which there was it was a huge housing complex, and there were so many contractors, he couldn't get them to really work together to do the finishes. So he said, let's forget the finishes, let's leave the concrete. And the whole block is exposed, and they use a lot of different kinds of wood forms. So there's wood, you know, imprinted on the on the concrete and all other kinds of textures. So he started to use the raw concrete as the finish, as the texture. From there, there's a whole history of modern concrete blocks, and there's tons and tons of ugly versions of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's some more interesting, there's some more exciting, and there's a lot of really formal play because concrete is so liquid and plastic material.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we're going a little off topic. We're going to get back to your work here.
Right.
But for me, like, I think the two buildings I think of immediately, brutalist in my mind, would be the Breuer Building, like where the old Whitney Museum was in New York. Yeah. Like, would you consider that a brutalist building?
Yeah, but it's, I mean, people think of brutalism more raw, and that's quite a refined building, but I think it's a great example,
And then I guess the other one, which is a building here, it's no longer in existence now, but it was recently torn down, but it was
police station.
The police station,
right.
And was that considered a brutalist building too as well?
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely, and that was...
As a Les Stetson's work, right? Was that his work?
Was it?
I think, I'm not sure.
I mean, so it also had a lot of textures with raw concrete, the way it was, ugly, cute, it was, you know, it was... Yeah. You know, some people love it, some people hate it, and that's what brutalism is like. And there's a big resurgence of it at the moment, and it's a love-hate kind of thing. Yeah, currently we've been working with a kind of special concrete called geopolymer concrete, which is a low-carbon concrete. So it's in response to the use of concrete, which is basically is 8% of global anthropogenic emissions. So the use of just Portland cement in concrete is more CO2 emissions than all of transportation and other things put together, right? So it's a huge problem that's kind of people don't talk about. It's a little bit of a white elephant. So there's other kinds of concrete that people are trying to use, and one of them is this geopolymer concrete.
Which is what this project at Plugin is involved with,
part of the sculpture is made of this geopolymer concrete, you know, which is 80% less or 90% less CO2 producing in the production of it.
And I'm assuming that it hasn't become used in wide use because it's too expensive in some way, or there's not enough profit margin, or what's kind of holding people back at this point?
Yeah, I mean, it's made from recycled building or industrial waste materials like fly ash, and is also made from metacolin, and it's mixed with an alkali solution. So because it's recycled materials, it's hard to, there's like the codes, you know, don't really reflect it. It has to be made specifically.
Like for structural kind of code and stuff like that.
Exactly.
It's a bit more trickier to get it to code.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, the concrete industry is huge, and, you know, it's not...
They've got a lot to lose by changing things, right?
There's vested interest against it.
Yeah.
And the alkali solution is, you know, relatively more expensive. But, you know, if, say, they had a tax on Portland cement, which there should be, you know, then this concrete would be quite reasonable. And it is used for many things. There's an airport in Australia made from this concrete. There's a sustainable research center in Australia made from this concrete. It's used a lot in India because there's a lot of recycled waste material there.
I remember, like, we were talking to a person last night, and he mentioned that somebody made a building in the 60s from it too, right in California. I forget the architect.
That was a similar kind of concrete. Yeah. I think that there's always other kinds of concrete that are better than using Portland cement. But, I mean, I don't want to get too hung up on the concrete part because that's just part of the show. But I should just say that a main part of the show is this sculpture using concrete bricks.
Yeah.
That it's combined geopolymer concrete, so low-carbon concrete, so it has a sustainable element, but also recycled aggregate or recycled concrete. And that recycled concrete comes from the Hudson Bay Company building. You know, this building was transferred to the Southern Chiefs organization, and they're making a courtyard the size of a football field within the Hudson Bay building.
And so they've got excess concrete.
So there's a lot of concrete coming out of there, and I work with the crusher of the concrete, and I got the aggregate. And so I mix that exact material from the Hudson Bay building with the sustainable cement to make these bricks one by one. And I'm using them in a sculptural way. I'm piling them up.
There's a seriality to them, right?
Like, yeah. That comes from us. We're really focused on using architectural elements in expressive ways. So we often use infrastructural elements in expressive ways. But we're making screens out of the bricks.
Okay, gotcha.
These bricks, these concrete bricks. And the screens are very important because you can see, you can actually see the bay building through the bricks. So
right.
It's a huge reference to the context and to the site of the exhibition. And it's, you know, signifying of sort of transformation of the Hudson Bay Company, but also of material. Also of, you know, transition to hopefully more ecological materials that's really badly needed in the concrete industry. But the wider context of us dealing with the building is us just dealing with the context, dealing with the site, and dealing with space. So
yeah, I mean, you talking about it now, I mean, it seems like this is a very site-specific piece.
Yeah,
right.
No, it's all about the site.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's pretty interesting too.
Yeah, I think of it as look, you know, looking at the context and making the context into a new context in the gallery. So making a context out of a context, and this context, see one through the other. There's a relationship. You compare them, and you have a new perception of the existing context through another context. So
Like I literally feel like you're playing with perception.
Definitely, yeah. And the screen refers to that, you know, because you can see through the screen, so you're kind of aware of seeing. So it refers to the act of perception itself, and we're constructing this context of perception. So beyond the bricks and the aggregate from the local site and from across the street from the gallery, we also harvested goldenrod and used that to.
What's goldenrod?
It's a local plant. Actually, we worked with Helga Peterson. She helped us the dyeing of fabric from goldenrod. So, and it has a kind of yellow green color.
Okay, is that color used in the exhibition or?
Yeah, there's a green gauze curtain.
Okay, right.
So, curtain covers one glass wall of the gallery.
Right.
So you look through the window and into the context through the plant-based dyed gauze curtain. And goldenrod kind of has restorative and healing aspects, and so does gauze. So, and okay. You know, we're using concrete in a kind of reparative way as well, and also referring to the transformation of Hudson Bay. So there's a kind of, you know, kind of healing aspect to the whole exhibition.
So it's almost like, how do we think of using concrete in healing ways?
You know, just not making so much CO2 in the process is thinking about the planet, right?
Yeah.
And thinking about having a screen to look at the environment in a different way is important. And so there's the elements in the exhibition are basically these two screens and then these other kind of tables that are made from tyndallstone, which is a very common material of government buildings and prestige buildings, and
it's very specific to Manitoba.
Yeah, it's found in Manitoba. It's characterized by these fossils that are in it. It's used around the world. It's a very significant material, and it's used in the Hudson Bay. And we went. I went to the same quarry where the Gillis quarries, where the tyndallstone comes from, and I got other remnant pieces, and I used that to construct other kind of furnishings in the space. So there's three tables that could be possibly used as seating or for an event as well.
So I got a little side sort of simple question here, but I noticed with the cast bricks which you folks made that there's a certain color there. I'm just wondering if you could talk about the color and the use of that color.
Yeah, I mean, you know, color is a big part of our practice.
Yeah, well, that's partly why I brought it up.
We always try to use color associated with architectural elements that will change a space, and so that the color is actually an architectural element, and often we associate an architectural element as a color, so that also influences the space and the perception of the space. So we really try to use color in a spatial way. These bricks, they're sprayed different colors in a gradient.
Yeah, there's
a
gradation. Yeah,
Another way we could have done it was to use pigment, but it's just extremely expensive to get bright pigment. And the kind that I was counting on getting what didn't exist here, a kind of liquid pigment for concrete, I couldn't get it. So in the end, I would have preferred to use pigment, but we sprayed them, but we got the right color. And there's also kind of experimental quality about the whole brick production and the show itself. And a lot of the bricks, because this geopolymer mix is still experimental. It's not really one mix. There's many ways to do it, and it's not really kind of even perfected, you know, even though there is a lot of construction using it. But for me to use it, there's no there's no formula out there to really that's reliable. So I use all the experiments and the bad bricks also in the construction. So there's an aesthetic of decay as well. So it's constructive and deconstructive.
Would you say it's also a record of experimentation?
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Record of its own production. But yeah, I mean, it's forming this screen, but one actually is much more clean and was more touched up than the other. So there's a dialogue also between the two screens in terms of one is more refined, more constructive, and the other is more decayed and more dissolving.
Now, it's been a while since I've seen the work. I'd say maybe about a week or so ago, and I'm trying to think, like, which is the one that's maybe more refined, the one closer to the window, or...
Yeah, that's right.
I noticed, like, with the shapes, in terms, you know, one is kind of a curved sort of shape, and I'm assuming that's to do with creating the screen effect. Would that be an accurate statement?
Definitely. It's sort of to create space, but it's also so that it can be an unsupported screen.
Right.
So that shape can support itself.
Yeah.
And the angle can support itself. If we made a single wall, it might fall down, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other piece, like, can you talk about that a bit?
The ceiling?
Yeah.
There's a number of pieces, and hopefully it's a kind of a dialogue of...
Okay.
Sort of ecological approaches or thinking in the site or just actually material as narrative is a big part of the thinking. So there's the actual material of the Hudson Bay coming in, and there's that narrative. But then we invited Eleanor Bond to show paintings of these sort of very, very sort of animistic and figurative rock formations. They're in the English countryside. And she presents these paintings in this context, and it gives a kind of this kind of notion of deep time and the earth, and this sort of maybe an animistic notion to minerals, to inorganic matter, to rocks. And,
that brings up another point. Like yesterday, we were talking, and you mentioned that not everything from nature is organic.
Yeah, there's the inorganic world too, rocks and minerals, and paint is usually made from minerals, it's inorganic. There's also, so we use inorganic and organic paints, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, the earth is nature is not only organic,
right.
It's biological, I guess.
But, right, right.
But the inorganic world is huge, right? It's the mineral world, the world of rocks, and
So, maybe I'd like to just, we don't have much time left. We've got maybe about 8 minutes or so, but I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about this idea, and we kind of alluded to it right at the beginning in terms of, mentioning this idea of you having a multidisciplinary practice, but I'm wondering if we could talk about this idea of, like, your work kind of being this combination of architecture, sculpture, and... In some ways, even painting. In some ways, and
definitely.
And the history of interior design mixed in there too. In some ways, I think. And
sure.
So it's like, what sort of prompted you to go that direction? But I'm wondering if you can talk about maybe some of those ideas in terms of prompted the current direction that's now been, I would say, a major force in your work for the last 2 decades or maybe 3 decades even.
Yeah, I grew up, drawing and interested in drawing and art.
Yeah.
And I went into architecture, and I studied architecture, but I was still interested in art.
Yeah.
And I noticed in architecture that color was really not taken seriously.
Yeah, like I feel like color is more of an interior thing than
sure.
and even then it's still kind of...
Exactly.
And
maybe I should mention here another piece in the show that is from my grandmother that we included.
Oh.
And it's a piece of Morning Glory Flowers. It's the first piece in the show. It's a piece with green and blue, and this green and blue really matched the colors that we had already imagined for the show. And then we saw the painting later, and we thought, wow, it's really matching how we envisioned the colors for the show. And my grandmother... It's an homage to her, and she really taught me about color. She was always looking at everything in terms of paint, actually.
It's
paint's gray sky with cerulean blue.
So she looked at the world through a painter's lens.
And she's always talking like that. So that was kind of ingrained on me, and just her joy of color, and she taught me to paint.
So interesting. So the show then has this kind of historical reference to the Hudson Bay. in terms of the transformation and the evolution that's going on there architecturally. But it also has a reference to you in terms of like family lineage too.
Also, I think we're visualizing these histories that are different kinds of histories, like even Eleanor's Rocks, the history of the bay, and the transformative nature of that,
and how
landscape, and my grandmother.
And how does your partner fit in with all of this too, with Louise's sort of interpretation of things? Like she's,
I mean, we really bonded early on about color and color and space, and that's what energizes our practice. So you mentioned about art and architecture, and so that's what I kind of focused on after my architecture school, was how can I use color in architecture?
Yeah.
And I started to do installations like that, combining painting and architecture.
Yeah, like there's a building, we're literally in an institution that's got one of your pieces here, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Can you talk about that piece really briefly?
It's the Duckworth Corridor. It's a bridge across the road. I forget which road, but it connects two buildings at the U of W, and there's an exposed truss that characterizes this walkway, and there's windows behind that. So they wanted us to do some color piece, and there's also parts of a wall in the corridor, and I think they expected us to paint the wall and make a mural or something, but we actually just painted the truss, and we painted certain parts of the truss.
So here again, this engagement of architecture with color, right?
Yeah,
as opposed to being a mural, quote unquote, right?
Exactly. So there's these dynamic colors that as you walk down the corridor, it reveals more and more color, because the piece of the truss parallel to the walkway is white. It's the other angles that are colored. So it's been a perception.
Yeah. Right. I was just going to say, so it's like the piece at Plugin, you're playing with perception again.
Certainly.
Interesting. Yeah. So we got maybe about 4 minutes left. Yeah. But any final words, like anything that you feel like we missed maybe that you'd like to talk about a bit?
Not specifically.
No.
Yeah. I like this project is this sort of dialogue of these histories, and hopefully a transformative history and a reparative history. And it's coming out of recent work I did in concrete, and that's where the name comes from. I did a piece called Bet on Waves, and then I taught a course I called Bet on Waves, and then the show ended up being called Bet on Waves. But it's more than and concrete; it's about all these relationships. But the idea of Bet on Waves is the fact that concrete and other materials, you know, have different zeitgeist, right? You know, concrete, like this sort of, it's such a bad material now, but there'll be other concretes in the future, and there was concretes in the past, different kinds of mixes. So there's waves of technologies that affect how we affect the world and affect us at the same time, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, this is sort of a super simple and obvious statement, but you know, I mean, the whole world is thinking about, like, how do we do things in a more sustainable way.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of like, this project is completely pointing to potential options to utilize concrete in a more sustainable way.
Yeah, no, I think it's a conversation that just should be embedded into everything.
Yeah.
But you can't forget the aesthetics, right? That's often, often sustainable work is, it doesn't have to be ugly, you know?
Any thoughts for any other artists out there that are kind of combining architecture and installation together? Any thoughts for them?
I don't know. I think using space and, you know, of course it's this notion of sculpture in the expanded field. You know, things don't have to be in a gallery.
Yeah.
Things can, you know, so we're bringing the context in and creating a new context, but I think you of course can create art anywhere and everywhere. And
And
it's just how you frame it, how you think about it, and how it's
revealed. Doesn't have to be this autonomous object.
Yeah, definitely that's one of the main points, for sure.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should we'll wrap things up. I just want to emphasize that Beton Waves, current exhibition up at Plugin ICA by Louise Withoft and Rodney Latourelle, who I'm talking with here with Rodney. It's going to be up until, what is it, November 1st, Rodney?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So that's Saturday, November 1st at Plugin ICA. Do check out Plugin's website at plugin.org, I believe is their website. And there'll be gallery hours there to check out Rodney and Louise's show,
I think on Thursday it's open later till 3 p.m.
So there's lots of times to check it out. I know that schools have come and done tours of it, and so it's
Yeah, in the morning it has really nice shadows, so that's another tip maybe.
Okay.
It's really changing during the day, and yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, like I've only been there, I think both times I think I've been there only at night. So it's like, I'm sure it's got to be a completely different experience for sure. So, well, but thank you very much, Rodney. I really appreciate your time. And I hope we've done some service to your important work here. I know that there's a very interesting trajectory in terms of what you've done with your work. And wish you all the best in the future with future projects. Do you have any other future projects lined up at this point? Or are there other sort of ideas that you're working on that you'd like to share before we call it quits?
We're working on like a number of things.
Yeah. They're sort of in progress at this point.
Progress. But I hope our public art piece in Toronto opens at some point soon because they were...
Right, in the subway system, yeah.
But
yeah, you know, I was talking to somebody else who, I think, I forget who it was.
Dagmar Agenda also?
Or no, it was like, I think it was like April...
Hickox,
yeah, had one too as well.
Yeah.
So it's.
I think they installed the wrong gauge of rail or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
Billions of dollars. Yeah.
It's
a huge mess.
Yeah.
I'm hoping to tour the show. You know, so
yeah.
Any
I mean, that'll be interesting.
Galleries or curators.
That'll be interesting too, right? Because it's like you've got something that's sort of been...
Some used bricks.
but it's this idea of like you've created something for this specific context, but then it can be recontextualized as something else, I think, which would be interesting.
Or I would work in this way at another site.
Right. Sort of thinking about local materials there and how do you recycle them into your work potentially.
Mm, for sure.
Yeah. Well, that'd be really interesting too, I think. Well, I guess we'll wrap it up, but thank you very much, Rodney.
Thank you. Thank you, Derek.
All right.
Great to talk to you. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So that's it for Rodney Luttrell. This is an interview from October 17th, 2025, here on CKW 95.9 FM. This is a recorded interview with Rodney Luttrell. And once again, do check out the exhibition at Plugin ICA until November 1st. All right, we'll be back next week, Thursday at 5:30. Talk to everybody then. Bye-bye.
Stand by just as he and stood by just as yet. When he gets drunk and he gets the money, the cash, the welfare check, the stuff, throws him out into the street. He's such a whip, he'll spit you out. This money minded son of a bitch will not have many in hand. All I can do is pray to God he'll suffer. A picnic man in a tip, he's getting from his office desk. Many places he has been and many more he'll visit yet. Well, without his mummy's pride and kisses, without his country's confidence, without the dying man's permission, without no guilt or consequence, this narrow-minded son of a bitch has not a wound to mend. Losing lots of blood. It's not his night. His butt's up tight. And his face and name are covered in blood. When he watches TV all-star wrestling, slams six of heels, hits his wife and wrecks a car, and spends a long dark night in jail. Well, the rich man comes and asks him, does he know the mess he's in? Since he turned to Jesus, they'll bail him out and buy him jail.
listening to